from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening forum hour, the Internal Revenue Service weighed in last week to say that the online currency Bitcoin should be treated as property and not like money. The decision pits those who favor more regulation against those who want a more free-willing market for Bitcoin. We'll discuss what it means for Bitcoin owners, investment firms, startups, and the market for cryptocurrency next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning, and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Last week, the Internal Revenue Service declared that Bitcoin, the leading cryptocurrency computer-driven online money system, is property and not currency, which means each time you use it to buy something, it is the same as cashing in shares of a stock, and it will trigger a potential income tax liability. First introduced back in 2008 on a cryptography litserv, Bitcoin with no banks, credit cards, government, or transaction fees is growing to over $100 million processed last year in transactions and is no longer used just by libertarian activists, hackers, and drug dealers or other illegal money exchangers. But the IRS has ruled the virtual and stateless digital currency is not legal tender in any jurisdiction and will be taxed at capital gains rates, which means that investors will need to keep extensive records. And in this morning's opening forum hour, we want to discuss the significance of the ruling and the debate over Bitcoin and its future. Joining us in studio is Robert McMillan. He is senior writer for Wired Magazine and frequently writes about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. His recent article, "The Fierce Battle for the Soul of Bitcoin," was featured in the April issue of Wired. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Nick Weaver, who's here in studio with us. He's senior researcher in networking and security with the International Computer Science Institute at UC Berkeley. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we also want to welcome Patrick Merck, who joins us from Seattle. He is general counsel for the Bitcoin Foundation. Welcome, Patrick Merck.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Glad to have all of you. And let me begin with Bob McMillan, who has done really yeoman work in terms of describing Bitcoin and making it comprehensible to those of us who had, shall we say, a higher bar. As I sort of tackled the whole question of Bitcoin and what it is, it really seemed like initially, still seems like maybe the step into a new economy. We'll hear different views perhaps from Nick Weaver on that. But it's also, I think, important to know that there's no Federal Reserve behind this. This is a global network of computers and laws of supply and demand, no federal intrusions, anything like that. This is all the dream of it. How's all this changed by the IRS ruling?
Well, the IRS ruling is sort of the latest in a series of steps toward bringing Bitcoin into the mainstream. And I think that it complicates things for people who own Bitcoin. Now you're going to have to, per the IRS rules at least, keep track of all of your transactions every time you buy a cup of coffee with Bitcoin. Technically, that's an incident that the IRS might be interested in. There are tax implications to that. But the bigger picture is that, you know, Bitcoin started as this sort of neat, fun crypto project, and it's kind of become a currency, and it's also kind of become just a network that allows you to exchange money. And as the government has sort of walked through the Bitcoin landscape, it's figured out, it's sort of decided, okay, we're going to enforce this, we're going to make you do that. And it sort of has changed the way Bitcoin works. In the very early days, it was kind of wide open and Wild West, even in the United States.
It makes it more legitimate. It makes it maybe more of a viable currency then?
Yeah, no, it's guidance. This is what the people in the Bitcoin community have asked for a long time. They've asked, you know, there's been this big gray area with respect to the IRS. So now we know what they think. It might be onerous. It might appear onerous to people that own Bitcoin, but at least we have a map.
Well, but the title of your article in Wired is indicative of something you call about the soul of Bitcoin. Some would say, how can money or any kind of currency have soul? But there's a battle for that soul. It's between those who want more regulation, more mainstream, more pragmatic acceptance, I suppose, and those who still want to be like the Wild West and anarchic.
Yeah, and those two visions of Bitcoin it's perfectly reasonable to expect them to live together. But at the same time, I have a sense that if the government in the United States makes it really, really onerous to sort of legitimately transact in Bitcoin, people will just sort of walk away from that. And the Bitcoin network allows you a lot of flexibility. In some ways, it's like cash, but it's cash that's traceable. So there are these weird ways in which you can do anonymous cash-like transactions over the internet with Bitcoin, but you can also be completely tracked at certain ways once you do that.
And what does this do for the Silk Road and all this underworld kind of use of Bitcoin that certainly we've read a great deal about in the news?
Well, I mean, you look at the Silk Road. It seems to me that the federal government did a pretty good job of tracking the money and using the way Bitcoin works to get intelligence in that case. So I think before that, people felt, people would say Bitcoin is this sort of anonymous, like it's like cash on the internet. And after the Silk Road, there's sort of people started to realize that the fact that everything is publicly logged that happens with Bitcoin can actually be a very powerful tool for law enforcement as well.
But would there be the temptation now for, hoarding rather than spending to avoid capital gains taxes?
I don't know. I mean, if you look at the way the Bitcoin's price has moved since December, I guess you actually are getting write-offs, with the value of it has dropped. But the point you make that, Bitcoin is sort of is this buy and hold phenomenon, I think it is a good point. I mean, this is sort of one of the big tests that will face the currency over the next year.
Excuse me, buy and hold and boom and bust too.
Right. Yeah. But I think the test is whether it's really going to be useful for buying things, and this IRS ruling makes it harder. I mean, it makes it much more complicated to just buy something with Bitcoin. But that's, to me, that's sort of the interesting question ahead of Bitcoin is whether, obviously people have made money just buying it and sort of relying on the intense publicity around it to drive up the price, and then they sell it. And it's sort of, it's kind of less interesting to me as a speculative investment than it is as a new type of currency or a new way of paying for things over the internet.
Well, people have made a lot of money, but we'll talk maybe about Mt. Gox, which brings up some serious questions too, because that was a considerable loss of money. But let me get Patrick Merck in this, who's general counsel with Bitcoin Foundation. And I think, Patrick Merck, from your standpoint, this all bodes well for the future of Bitcoin. And to a great degree, I think, is it safe to say that you feel there is always regulation going on?
Yeah, so it certainly does. I agree with the fact that the guidance from the IRS helps legitimize things a little bit more and gives people some comfort transacting in the Bitcoin project right now. So that's been a good thing generally. The issue I think I have is that in the guidance, they do favor investment over using Bitcoin as a currency. And I can understand how they would come to that decision, just looking kind of at their statute and the rules that they have on the books right now. But from a policy perspective, it may be a poor choice. The predominant uses for Bitcoin right now, the first one is as a currency, and the second is as a store of value. And what you see happen is within the same Treasury Department, you see FinCEN, which seems to be more neutral in its treatment of Bitcoin and promoting the use of Bitcoin both as a store of value and as a payment network, that is, as a currency, by allowing people to freely transact within the network and just putting the regulatory burden on the entry points and the exit points, the exchanges, which I think is highly appropriate. With the IRS guidance, what you've done is by not treating Bitcoin as a currency and treating it as property or an asset, you have favored the use of Bitcoin as an investment vehicle, which does probably help quite a few people who hold Bitcoin today, because currency treatment would be, from a tax perspective, worse than capital gains treatment. but it disfavors its use as currency because of the reporting requirements that are going to go into tracking every transaction you make, the cup of coffee you buy, tracking your cost basis on what you spent, the Bitcoin that you bought and then spent on a cup of coffee. That's just an added layer of difficulty that's unnecessary when you're using Bitcoin just as a payment network, just as a currency.
You're going to need some ongoing technological changes, though, to keep these exchanges stable and to keep everything safe. I think that goes without saying. I mentioned, for example, or alluded to earlier, Mt. Gox, which was, you might want to talk about that, because that was quite a major seismic earthquake in terms of Bitcoin.
Yeah, so I can't comment on Mt. Gox specifically because there is an ongoing criminal investigation going on there. But just generally talking about exchanges, what we've seen is the early exchange types are very trust-heavy in the sense that you put your money into an exchange, you buy Bitcoin there, you leave your Bitcoin and store it at the exchange. And that exposes you to a great deal of counterparty risk as a consumer. Or an investor trying to get in and out, or even as a merchant. And there are ways to avoid that counterparty risk or mitigate against it with better systems, better technology. You can see people are developing that right now, creating non-custodial accounts for Bitcoin so that when you're buying Bitcoin, you don't have to trust that the exchange or service provider will not get hacked or run off with your Bitcoin. And you're seeing better integrations on the banking side so that they're not holding custodial accounts of your U.S. dollars or your euros or your yen.
I don't want this to be mysterious, by the way. I should just clarify for listeners that Mt. Gox was a leading exchange and there were millions of dollars that just disappeared. But there's also some concern, isn't there, on your part about the fact that Bitcoin is banned in certain countries?
Well, I don't know that Bitcoin has been banned in any countries. I've heard some. There's been a lot.
Well, it's filed for bankruptcy, and China is cracking down on it, right?
Yeah, China certainly has taken an aggressive stance to payment processors moving money into Bitcoin exchanges, and that's okay. Where you're going to see probably the most regulatory burden are in countries that have heavy capital controls. These are the countries that want to manage their currencies aggressively. And systems like Bitcoin, I think Bitcoin is the hottest of hot money. It enables people to move capital quickly across borders. And if you want to manage your currency, if you want to inflate your currency or keep to a certain peg to a certain currency, it's going to be difficult for you to do that if people can move in and out very quickly across borders without permission.
I know that as an advocate of Bitcoin, you'd like to have it stay here and flourish here in the United States because you feel that if it doesn't, it's going to be providing jobs and economic advantages elsewhere. But what do you see in terms of this divide, these two visions of Bitcoin that have been in conflict? I mean, call it the libertarian anarchic view of Bitcoin as opposed to the one that is much more in favor of mainstream.
Yeah. I don't know that I see the divide quite the same way. I think that you've had a lot of different types of people involved in Bitcoin for a long time. Some of the louder voices have gravitated towards one stream of political thought, but that doesn't mean that everybody involved has. I'm neither a liberal nor an anarchist. I've been involved for a while now, and I haven't seen that kind of clash personally. I think most people understand that Bitcoin has always been regulated. It was just a matter of how those regulations apply to specific uses of it. The protocol itself is just software, but when you build a
I know we're having some problems with your line, Patrick. We're going to try to get back to you. Patrick Murkigan is General Counsel of Bitcoin Foundation and with us from Seattle. The mudslides there. I don't know. I hope they can get to his phone wires. But Nick Weaver is here with us in studio, and he is a strong critic of Bitcoin. I think maybe that even be expressing it somewhat mildly. Nick, let me go right to the point here. I mean, you think it's going to collapse and collapse on its own because of its volatility?
It's more subtle. I love Bitcoin, the technology. There's some really clever ideas in there. But I don't believe that Bitcoin is a secure or as a good currency, and as a investment vehicle, it's pure speculation. You are basing the idea that somebody else will buy it for more value. It doesn't generate rental income or anything else. So in many ways, to me, it resembles Beanie Babies.
Well, talk about that in terms of the amount of money.
Yes, actually, that if you look at the peak sales of Beanie Babies during that hype was on the order of $1 billion or two a year. And if you look at the net value of all the Bitcoins mined this year at the current price, it's about $1 billion or two.
What about the notion that it's becoming much more acceptable and merchants are sort of like salmon, you know, going to Bitcoin now? I mean, the numbers have increased.
The dirty little secret is they aren't actually taking Bitcoin. What it is they're contracting with a payment processor that takes the Bitcoin and turns it back into dollars, which means the people on the other side had to go the other way. They had to either mine the Bitcoins or buy the Bitcoins for the transaction to work. So the real cost of a Bitcoin transaction is the merchant turning it into dollars, the Bitcoin transaction itself, which is almost free, and whoever bought the Bitcoins had to get all the transaction costs of buying Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is actually annoying to buy because you can't buy Bitcoin with a credit card or a bank transfer and immediately get your Bitcoin out.
How secure, from your perspective, how safe is Bitcoin?
It is both very secure and very insecure. The Bitcoin cryptography is amazingly well done. But at the same time, you can't actually store your Bitcoin wallet, your public key that says you can spend your Bitcoin, on an internet-connected computer, because if an attacker takes over that computer, your money disappears. And there have been all sorts of cases of malcode that steals people's Bitcoins.
So Fort Knox and the Federal Reserve and all those things are better and more trustworthy than Bitcoin?
Is that no, it's that if you look at the financial system we use with banks, they have the attitude of anything electronic has to have at least a short-term undo button. Your credit card has a undo button, and they use that to mitigate fraud, to go, oh, something bad has happened, let's go backwards. Bitcoin has no undo button. If a transfer takes place, it takes place, which means you have to be very, very secure about preventing bad transactions in the first place, which means you have to print out your access key to your Bitcoins and store it in your safe, or use this complex system where you have multiple devices and both have to agree and all sorts of other things to get around the fact that you can't go backwards.
Patrick Merck, do we have a good line here, I hope, with you?
Well, I hope so, yeah.
Yeah, I think that sounds much better. You were fading in and out. Were you able to hear some of Nick Weaver's arguments about Bitcoin?
Sure.
Yeah, I'd like to get your response to what he just said.
Yeah, so no, Bitcoin doesn't have an undo button, and that's by design. But there are ways to mitigate against fraud and risk and manage this in the system the way it exists today. There's something within the Bitcoin protocol. It's a programming language within there called Script, and it allows you to do some really cool things. And one of those things is to create automated escrow services. So the idea is, instead of always going back in time on a transaction, you can protect against risk and fraud by holding things in escrow, and you can automate it. So now it's economically viable to put 5 cents in escrow. It's economically viable to put a thousandth of a penny going through a paywall at a newspaper into escrow. You could never do that before. And when I say you automate the whole function, you know, let's talk about what that looks like. If I want to go buy something on Overstock.com, I can go and I can place a payment using Bitcoin. I can place it into escrow. And the escrow can just can be a piece of software that automatically looks for UPS delivery confirmation. And once UPS delivers my goods to my house and confirms that delivery, then it will release the funds to Overstock. Now, I don't worry too much about Overstock's non-performance, but you can see how that could be incredibly useful on eBay or other systems like that where it's a little bit more peer-to-peer. You can protect yourself. You can set up these escrow mechanisms at very low dollar amounts. It's still economically feasible, and it protects everybody from risk. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't add any cost into the system the way that these look-backs kind of do. So there's a cost to that undo button. It's actually quite expensive. The consumers don't see it, but the merchants do. And that's why you see them paying, you know, 2.5 to 3% of every transaction in fees back to these networks that process payments for them.
Again, Patrick Merck is General Counsel of Bitcoin Foundation. And Nick Weaver, you say what to these escrow mechanisms?
You have to actually use it on your own wallet, because the problem is theft on your own wallet.
You should describe what a wallet is.
A wallet is basically permission to say, I can spend my bitcoins. That this is a bit of magic information that if somebody else gets a copy of, they can steal your bitcoins, which means you have to protect this. And the other thing is...
Which is why the password is so important.
Why your computer is so important.
Well,
if the bad guy controls your computer, you lose your money. And we're seeing bad guy code do this. But the other thing is this cost argument is, again, not true. Because in order to buy bitcoins, I have to go through basically a cash equivalent step. Because Bitcoin by default is irreversible. So let's say you're trying to sell me a Bitcoin and you accept a credit card. Well, credit card's reversible, so you have this risk involved. And so as a result, to buy a Bitcoin, it basically takes cash or cash equivalent. And that means that the real cost of a Bitcoin transaction is not the 0.01% that the Bitcoin network charges. It's the 1% that the merchant faces for turning bitcoins into dollars, and the 2 to 3% or more real world cost of actually buying bitcoins.
Let me ask Robert McMillan to weigh in here. I mean, you're the journalist in this. Can you synthesize here?
You know, a lot of the arguments against Bitcoin are very similar to the arguments that were made against the internet in the early days, right? It was very difficult to use, and there were all kinds of reasons people thought that it would never take off. But the thing that's interesting to me about Bitcoin is that it's this software, you know, it's this extensible software. It's very open. Our financial networks haven't traditionally been opened into the same level that Bitcoin is. And so, yeah, there are all these problems, but then there are all these opportunities for companies like, to solve the problems. A year ago, it was extremely difficult to buy Bitcoins online. And now there's a company called Coinbase that has made that much easier. So, I'm kind of watching from the sidelines to see if the problems that Nicholas talks about will be solved. I think he makes a lot of valid points, especially with respect to the security problem. You know, the fact that it is like cash and can be gone, you know, as soon as somebody gets access to that private key has stung a lot of people who have bought Bitcoins. But
and what about Mt. Gox in this context?
Well, I mean...
you could talk about it, right?
I could talk about it, yeah. I mean, Gox is an example of the sort of the immaturity of the businesses that have been traditionally involved in Bitcoin. Gox was not a well-run business. And for, I did a story in November talking about the nightmare that company was. And, I think people have sort of within the Bitcoin community have known that it had a lot of problems. And so when it imploded, they weren't terribly surprised. But, you know, there were definitely investors who didn't know about that.
I learned from your article that there's kind of a division also between Ben Reeves and Brian Armstrong, I mean, in terms of what they've set up. You want to – well, let's hold that because
sure.
Actually I want to bring our listeners into this, and we've got about a minute until our break. And it's an opportunity for you to join us. And, in fact, we welcome you joining the program. Also, if you have questions or comments talking about the IRS decision, which looms pretty large over the future of Bitcoin, but what do you believe the future of Bitcoin to be and how involved are you in Bitcoin? And if you have questions or comments, join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us at that toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or communicate with us simply by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with Robert McMillan of Wired and Nick Weaver of the International Computer Science Institute at UC Berkeley and Patrick Merck of the Bitcoin Foundation. Hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the Internal Revenue Service decision, which came about last Tuesday and essentially says that the online currency Bitcoin should be treated as property and not like money. And the decision pits those who favor more regulation against those who want a more free-willing market for Bitcoin. We're discussing what it means for Bitcoin owners, for investment firms, for, well, the market for what's been known as cryptocurrency and perhaps for startups as well. But you may want to join the conversation. We're talking with Robert McMillan, who's with us in studio, senior writer for Wired Magazine, frequently writes about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. And his recent article, The Fierce Battle for the Soul of Bitcoin, was featured in the April issue of Wired. Nick Weaver is also with us in studio. He's senior researcher in networking and security for the International Computer Science Institute at UC Berkeley. And Patrick Merck with us by phone from Seattle is general counsel for the Bitcoin Foundation. You can be part of the program, and indeed we welcome you to be part of the program. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Before I went to the break, and I don't want to necessarily dwell on this, but it's kind of fascinating in terms of local, sort of split when you go back to the history of Bitcoin between Ben Reeves and Brian Armstrong. Ben Reeves now with blockchain, more than, I guess, 1.3 million, and Brian Armstrong Coinbase, which is in San Francisco and has over a million, who have wallets. Actually, I think we just described what a wallet is, and some of you may have some questions just about Bitcoin. I mean, mining and what all these terms are, the whole lexicon of Bitcoin. So you're certainly welcome to join the program. But there are millions of coins that are out there, not literal coins, as Nick Weaver said, but, you know, that are being used for some kind of currency. And the anonymity of the currency was, I suppose, a great part of the lure. Bob McMillan, Max, for example, writes in an email here, Bitcoin can be used and traded untraceably. Tax avoidance part of its allure. Likely result of the IRS ruling will be to incentivize illegal use of Bitcoin.
Well, I think I heard Nick laughing when people were talking about anonymity in Bitcoin. You know, it's true that it can be used in a private and near anonymous way. But the fact is that Bitcoin is this public ledger where you track every, you know, anyone can track any transaction that happens in Bitcoin. The problem is these transactions just correspond to the addresses, and you don't know, unless you know the owner of that address, you don't know who that person is. So if you, but are there ways of cracking who the address belongs to? And once you do that, you get everything. You can see all the transactions somebody has made. So it's anonymous, but it's kind of not exactly.
Yeah, Nick Weaver, you want in here. Go ahead.
So like a concrete example is Mt. Gox. There was a revelation of Mt. Gox's internal data. Using that, you can actually tie a large number of transfers in and out of Mt. Gox to the actual transfers in the public Bitcoin blockchain.
Let me go to some questions here from listeners. Patrick Merck, let me go to you. Bill writes, this policy works for people who want to buy and sell Bitcoins. It won't work for people who want to use Bitcoins to buy and sell stuff. Suppose I get paid a Bitcoin a week and then spend them on rent, food, gas, etc. Am I really supposed to keep a log of each fraction of a coin in my possession with the dollar values when I got it, when I passed it on?
So the answer, as the guidance stands now, is yes. And I can say that as somebody who gets paid their entire salary in Bitcoin and is now going to have to do this. so that's something that we'll work on. We'll be filing comments with the IRS on this topic. There's a kind of a clear path forward for them, and that is to apply the $200 exemption that applies to currency transactions now and just apply it very narrowly in the context of these kind of unique digital assets called Bitcoin. And that really does solve a great many of the problems involved here.
Well, what about a question from another listener? Max says, if a few coders could create something as disruptive and untraceable as Bitcoin a few years ago, what could 10 coders do today with all they've learned from Bitcoin? What does Bitcoin 2.0 look like? The Internet needs cryptography for any commerce to be viable. Ultimately, doesn't this mean we'll always be able to find ways to secretly move money?
I agree with that. I mean, I think that that's a really interesting point because, and it's something that I believe the federal government is considering. Basically, Bitcoin is something they can work with right now, but if they kind of drive it underground, there will be another currency. There's no question.
This decision by the IRS was really to try to keep it from going underground.
I believe so. Yeah, I believe it. Like I said, it sort of gives Bitcoin owners a path. It's a complicated one at times, but the alternative is something that's much harder for federal investigators, law enforcement, the IRS to deal with it. And we've seen in the past, there's just in the black market, there's just such a thirst for these kind of digital currencies that it seems pretty clear that something else would come and it would be nastier.
Yeah, Nick Weaver.
I'd like to add that there are already alternatives cropping up all the time. So Ars Technica created one just for the heck of it. The number six cryptocurrency at this point, I think, is Dogecoin, which is literally an internet joke. And some do add new interesting features, too, like Ripple adds the notion of being able to do what's best described as quantum money, that if I write an IOU to Bob here saying I owe Bob $5, and if you will accept that IOU, we just actually created $5 out of thin air. We created positive five on Bob and minus five on me.
Our basic question here, Bob McMillan, let me go to you on this. Bitcoin versus PayPal, what's the difference?
Well, PayPal, they're a lower fee. I mean, PayPal charges you a 3% fee for certain transactions. Bitcoin, in theory, I can just send Bitcoin. I could send you some Bitcoins, Michael, and there'd be a very small fee amounting to maybe 5 cents or something like that on the transaction. So that's the basic thing is the fee. But also, Bitcoin is this open source software. It's the software that can be hacked, that can be extended, that people can write their own. You know, you can write your own software that interacts with the network. PayPal doesn't work that way. They control what happens in the back end with PayPal. If you want to join PayPal, there's some pretty strict controls on how that happens. Bitcoin is more open. The software is more open, and that's the thing that makes it interesting.
The open source makes the difference, yeah. And Patrick Merck, Chris wants to know, if someone wants to invest a small part of their portfolio in Bitcoin, how do you go about it? Is there an ETF, a mutual fund?
There is. If you're an accredited investor, Second Market has a ETF that's available. I know the Winklevoss twins are looking to take something public. But you can also buy and hold Bitcoins directly yourself. You can go through any of the number of exchanges that are out there right now. We were talking earlier about the consumer protection issues. You should definitely think about how you're going to store those Bitcoins in a safe way. You have a new startup called Zappo that just came out that's offering insured storage of your Bitcoin for you, which is a nice development. Along those regards. But the other way to get Bitcoin, of course, is we talk about buying Bitcoin and we talk about the cost of buying Bitcoin and things like that. I've never bought a Bitcoin. I have some. I've earned them all. I've earned them all through services. So it's another way to get Bitcoin. Earn them through your services and spend them instead of buying and selling them. Not all just about investors.
Nick Weaver, you want to add?
There is a lot of caveat emptor on Bitcoin exchanges. For example, the number two exchange right now, BTCE, is owned by unknown people in Eastern Europe. The best way, probably, if you're serious about buying Bitcoins for yourself, is a site called Local Bitcoins, where people can just meet up in person and buy and sell with cash.
All right, we're going to go to your calls in just a moment, but Nick, I want to go to this email from a listener named Rick, who writes, your anti-Bitcoin guest, Nick, has a lot of nerve, stating that Bitcoin is not a safe currency. When you think about the mighty dollar backed by $14 trillion in debt, which has spiraled upwards at a near exponential rate, one might be curious where the Wonderland dreamers will come to their senses. The disturbing thing about Bitcoin is that it is free from government control. There is a great need for this kind of currency. Thomas Jefferson and most of our founders would most certainly approve.
My response is, if that is your threat model, my investment would be gold and .223 ammunition. It's probably more effective if we actually do deal with a collapse.
All right, let's deal with some of our callers, and we begin with Joel as our first caller. Good morning.
Morning.
Yes, sir, you're on the air.
So my main concern about Bitcoin is, number one, it's really complicated as far as I can tell. And second of all, it requires a certain level of technological ability in order to use it. To me, it's just another way for people to create a divide between the haves and the have-nots.
Actually, the first point I want to go to here, Bob McMillan, I mean, it is complicated, and that might really hurt the, shall we say, ability of this as a regular exchange to move upward and continue to move upward.
Hey, money is complicated. I mean, you look at how money moves in the world, and it is extremely complicated. The thing is, with Bitcoin, because it's out in the open, we're talking about things like the blockchain and wallets and stuff like that. It comes back to this point about the early days of the internet. Yes, it's very complicated, and that's why these Silicon Valley investors are putting money into Bitcoin, is because they think they can make it simpler. I mean, if you look at Coinbase, their original business plan was basically, let's try and do PayPal for Bitcoin. Let's try and make it easy to use. That's a huge opportunity as far as the Silicon Valley people are concerned.
Well, that's certainly something that represents a strong investment for you, Patrick Mark, I imagine, right? Making it simpler for consumers and simpler for, startups and for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a high-risk environment for consumers right now, and people should know that, and you should not be putting your life savings into Bitcoin. It's maybe not a bad thing that it's technically difficult at this early stage for people to get in and out of it. There's a lot of work and infrastructure that needs to be built before we cross the chasm from early adopters to mass consumer adoption. It's happening, but we're not there yet.
Let me follow this up with an email from another listener named Rich and get your response, Patrick Mark. He writes, I'm finding it hard to be very interested in the nuances of how secure Bitcoin may or may not be, or what the tax consequences of using it are. Now, it seems that the larger question is, why does it have value at all, except that for at the moment, some folks have decided to believe it does. I suppose the same can be said for the U.S. dollar, but in that case, we have almost all agreed it does have value and has the organizational backing of the government we agreed to bind us. I believe that one day, soon, these folks may stop having such beliefs and whatever value some perceive will be zero, thus making the IRS rules on profits a moot point.
I think that, that criticism applies to gold as well,
yes, it does.
Except for gold is just harder to move, right? it's a fair criticism.
Did you want to comment, Patrick Mark?
Yeah, sure. So the intrinsic value of Bitcoin is going to be tied directly to its useful purpose for a number of different things. But what's really interesting, and it is like gold in this way, is with Bitcoin, you can create a unique digital asset. And you can use it as money, you can use it as a store of value, you can use it to, store your identity online. You can do a number of different things with it. As that becomes more useful, the value is going to go up. And so that's what people are working on right now. I am not an economist. All I know is that the market's usually right, and right now the market is valuing it at something. In the future, it may not. We'll just have to see.
Well, it's at about $600 now, last time I looked, but it went at one point from $13 to $1,200. Nick Weaver?
I'm not an economist either, but I've come to the conclusion the market can stay irrational longer than I can stay solvent. But the biggest concern I have about Bitcoin as an investment is, if you do believe in Bitcoin, the rational thing to do is never spend your Bitcoin, because it
Hoard
can
it.
Only go up.
Yeah.
But if you are believing in these ancillary uses rather than the use as a currency, the value can be so much less, because in terms of inscribing a digital contract, I only need a fraction of a cent in what's currently done in Bitcoin to do it, which would imply a much lower value for the non-currency operations.
Here's Jagadish joining us. Good morning. You're on Forum. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So my question is, the way I fundamentally understand currency, or most people do, is you do hard work and you earn money. But it seems like with Bitcoin, you do the hard work, earn money, then go buy all these complex computers and then mine one Bitcoin, which is probably worth less than all those computers. So I'm just wondering how that works.
Bob McMillan.
Well, mining is a small part of Bitcoin.
It's a lexical definition of mining.
But it's very important. I mean, so essentially, the Bitcoin network works on it's a peer-to-peer network. There are a lot of computers that are processing all of these transactions all the time. So they created this system called mining, and in fact, you could think of mining as really the point of Bitcoin. I mean, it's to pay these miners. So basically, the miners are all these computers that are processing all the transactions, and about every 10 minutes, they put together a block of all the transactions that have happened, and as a special bonus, one of them gets to award himself an extra 25 Bitcoins as sort of payment for providing that
network. So can we say
Bitcoin
is kind of a canary in a different kind of mine? you know, the old canary in a coal mine instead of, yeah, Nick Weaver, go ahead.
I think one thing that really helps to understand is that Bitcoin is like this public asset or balance sheet where everybody's bank balance is listed. And what the miners are doing is taking all the outstanding checks, stapling them together, and as a result of stapling the checks together, they get an extra 25 bitcoins. And the key magic, the brilliant part about the Bitcoin system is this stapling process, this mining proof of work is such that you basically have to, in order to break the staple and insert or change what's been recorded, have to do the same amount of work that was done in the stapling in the first place and the stapling of all subsequent bundles since, which means that this cryptographic protection, this mining process, is producing a really, really, really strong guarantee of the past. It really is saying this stack of checks is what happened.
It's hard to cheat it.
Yeah, from the sounds of it, it is. Let me get another caller on here. That's you, Don. Hi, welcome.
Oh, me and Milpitas?
Don and Milpitas, that's you, yeah.
Yeah, all right. I just wanted to say, you got to remember that in the early 1800s in this country, we didn't have a federal monetary units. You know, the banks were printing their own money. You had a dollar or $10 that was drawn on the Bank of Minnesota, but you didn't know if the Bank of Minnesota had enough money to back that bill up. That's the reason why we went to a federal system.
Well, we thank you for that historical footnote. I appreciate the call. In fact, let me go to some more listener comments. Facebook page. Tom writes, like Bitcoin, every currency has a functional use and a speculative use, but the functional use is usually tied to a geographic country. In that way, is Bitcoin like an invisible country? Patrick Mark?
Yeah, actually, usually when I talk about Bitcoin in this sense, you can refer to it as apolitical money or these different things. To me, it's a brand new global financial institution that is apolitical. It's its own financial institution, and that means money, it means, you know, property, it means assets, it means a lot of different things because it's this open, extensible platform. But it's fascinating. It's fascinating. And that's not as relevant to us in the Western world, but in the global South, where institutions are weak or non-existent, it could mean a lot to people. It gives people the opportunity to actually build assets and create wealth and store it for themselves. That's what's really fascinating and interesting about Bitcoin for me.
I want to read a comment from a listener named Frank who writes, the IRS has stated that to the best of our knowledge, Bitcoins are not currently authorized or adopted by a domestic or foreign government, end of quote. That is a lie, as the fact is Germany declared Bitcoin to be money, which is why Germany accepts tax payments in Bitcoin, and the IRS should be well aware of this. The IRS decision to tax Bitcoin is proof that they are controlled by the international banking cartel, whose control Bitcoin was created to bypass and subvert. The IRS's behavior provides a reason to call again for abolition or downsizing of the IRS. It is more proof that the federal government is all too often merely a puppet of crony capitalist big business and is therefore an enemy of progress, fairness, and the people. A possible solution to the Bitcoin spending problem might be to do all exchange of cryptocurrencies in Native American nations and thereby bypass the banksters' clutching hands and corrupted U.S. agencies. Bob McMillan.
Thank you.
You wanted that one.
I did. Well, and I want to there's one sort of side note on that, which I think is kind of interesting. It's true that Bitcoin is not a currency right now, but there are efforts underway to encourage countries that do not have their own currency to adopt Bitcoin as a national currency. And so
it's true about what he said about Germany, though, isn't it?
Well, that doesn't mean that for the purposes of the German tax department, it operates as a currency, that doesn't actually make it a currency in the eyes of the IRS. I mean,
it's not a Deutschmark. It's just, yeah.
But it is possible that a small country with no central bank could adopt Bitcoin as a currency. And I don't know if that would change. I mean, that could change the way that some of these federal interpretations of what Bitcoin is happen.
Well, another listener writes, you may have already covered this, but I want to know, how does Stripe fit into this discussion? Bob McMillan? We didn't cover it.
Yeah. So Stripe is adopting Bitcoin, as I understand it. But that's
what is Stripe exactly? You want to enlighten us here, Metric Burke?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah.
No, go ahead. What is we're finding out what Stripe is from you? Go ahead.
Sure. So Stripe is a payment processing network for mainly online. It's very developer friendly, so it's got a lot of traction. It's a great company, but I think what that shows is that Bitcoin is moving from store of value to currency, and we're seeing it happen before our eyes right now. And so Stripe is the latest example of a merchant processor who's starting to adopt Bitcoin, see the demand on the merchant side to start accepting the payments, and also to ease out kind of the issues around accepting Bitcoin and converting it into cash. A company like BitPay and Coinbase have seen dramatic growth in merchant adoption just over the past, you know, half of a year. I think BitPay, for example, has gone from 10,000 to over 30,000 merchants over the last 6 months, say. So it's just exponential growth in the pickup of Bitcoin being used as a currency.
I don't think Nick Weaver sees it that way, do you, Nick? I mean, that exponential nature of the growth?
No, I do, but it's obscuring the little fact that the merchants are then turning it into dollars, and so the system has to balance. And this is why I keep saying that the cost of a Bitcoin transaction is really the cost of dollar to Bitcoin and Bitcoin to dollar, because both of those steps had to occur somewhere along the point.
And that's what you would expect early days, right? You would expect that people are going to move Bitcoin to cash. What you're starting to see is this migration away from that now. So Overstock.com, I think, has said that they're holding on to about 10% of the Bitcoin they take in, and they're using it to pay overseas employees in cross-border transactions, which is really interesting because that's exactly the next step you would expect if you're going to see Bitcoin move from just, as you said, into an actual currency that's transacted globally.
Bob McMillan, here's a question online from one of our listeners, Chuck. Some may remember this story, but he'd like a little bit of greater enlightenment on how the IRS managed to track those transactions of the guy who was operating out of the San Francisco Library and doing so on the Silk Road.
Oh, well, I'm not I mean, they got his computer. So once you have Nicholas might know better the ins and outs of doing this. He sort of does this. Mm-hmm. But basically, once you have the computer, you have the keys, you can see, you know, that then once that it's sort of game over at that point. But
yeah,
in fact, it was even more subtle. Somehow, we don't know how, they discovered the servers of Silk Road. Using that, they were able to identify him as the guy probably running it and get his connection. And then what they did is they waited for him to go to the library, open up his computer, log in, and then tackle him while the computer was open so that everything was unlocked.
If the computer had shut, they would have lost the keys.
Yeah, it was a great scene for a movie.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you, Patrick Mark, from Vivian, who tweets, "What is Bitcoin actually mining?" And a few listeners have asked that.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead, and Nick will respond after you do. Go ahead.
Sure. So the mining is just payment processing and securing the network. That's the best way to think of Bitcoin mining. So it's sort of like what Visa and MasterCard and the Discover Network do. They take in payments. I think Nick had a good way of describing it. They bundle them up. They staple them together. They process it. So they process it, they add it into the transaction flow, and they secure the entire network. And they're compensated for that work. And that's how they're issued new Bitcoin.
Yeah, Nick, you wanted to
Real brilliance of it is that you can't change history, that it's really mining is actually not the best term. It's really more chiseling. They're carving into stone all these transactions.
Another listener tweeting, Carl says, "Consider that gold always has a significant commodity value. It doesn't fall to zero. Not so with Bitcoin." Patrick Merck?
Well, who knows? I mean, we'll see. Bitcoin is certainly what's called a high beta play. It's as likely to go to zero as it is to the moon. It's probably not going to land somewhere in the middle. But again, as Bitcoin has more useful purposes, that's going to support a higher and higher overall market cap. But even at, you know, near zero, Bitcoin as a protocol is still extremely useful for a number of different things. Notary services, creating unique digital assets for digital rights management and the copyright space. There are a number of different ways in which you could take the protocol if it lost a lot of its value. But I don't think it will.
What about these twins we keep reading about? You know, that tried to get more money out of Zuckerberg and claimed that they were responsible for essentially patenting or coming up with the idea for Facebook. I raise that because I remember the Hunt brothers trying to buy up the silver market. Yeah, Nick Weaver.
I just find it more interesting. Their investment opportunity for Bitcoin is you pay them money, they take the Bitcoins, they print the. Print out the public key for it, probably split it, store it securely, and charge you 1% of the Bitcoin stored every year for forever. That's the only investment that they're offering.
So you're saying it's not really a great
investment.
It's
speculation.
It's just all speculative. You know.
And if you actually do believe in Bitcoin, get the Bitcoins for yourself, store them in a secure place, and hold on to them.
Here's a listener, Bob McMillan, who writes, didn't 7% of Bitcoin disappear some weeks back?
That sounds like a reference to the Mt. Gox problems.
And that was 7%?
So I don't know that it was 7%, but I mean, certainly Mt. Gox lost a lot of Bitcoins, and Nick is trying to find out where they went. Nobody really knows what happened. There were allegations of hacking. There's obviously some incompetence in management of Mt. Gox, but I don't think the Bitcoins have disappeared. I think they're still on the blockchain.
Well, Bitcoin, final word from you on this, Bob McMillan, obviously is not going to disappear very much with us, despite the IRS ruling.
No, it's going to – I mean, the IRS ruling made things tricky for me because I was in Canada recently. I paid for a night at a condo. I stayed in Acapulco, but I used Bitcoin that I purchased with Canadian dollars. I have no idea how I'm going to account for this. And plus, I expensed it. So figure that out. Somebody, Patrick?
Well, if we have any accountants who want to offer pro bono work here, Bob McMillan could use your services. Thank you all, by the way, for actually enlightening us about Bitcoin and about the IRS decision declaring last week again that Bitcoin is not currency, it's property. I hope made this more enlightening. It's complicated territory, but like Bob McMillan said, money is complicated territory. Thanks to Bob McMillan, who's senior writer at Wired Magazine, and Nick Weaver, who's senior researcher in networking and security at International Computer Science Institute at UC Berkeley, and to Patrick Merck, general counsel from Bitcoin Foundation, who joined us from Seattle. Hope you will join us for another hour of Forum. We're coming up on an hour with Kelly Corrigan, who's written a book called Glitter and Glue, and I thought kind of the segue is that she says the most valuable currency of all is mother love. We'll go to that when we return. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.